My Govanin, welcome to the Tolkien Lore Channel. I'm the Tolkien Geek, and this is a video that I have thought about for a long time and just never gotten around to for one reason or another. But the idea that I want to talk about in this video is the idea that Saruman is kind of a template for the modern politician in a lot of ways. Tolkien, in a speech that he gave, I forget exactly where, I think it was somewhere in Denmark, but it was definitely on the continent somewhere, the European continent, talked about a bunch of different things to a group that was basically a fan group of his. And in it, he mentions towards the end, if I remember correctly, where he says it, that he doesn't see any Sauron active in the world, but he does see a lot of Sarumans, or a lot of Sauron's descendants. And it always made me think that he kind of himself thought of Saruman as kind of designed as a sort of mirror for a lot of political leaders of a certain stripe. And this kind of goes with the nature of politicians in general, because politicians, by their nature, do certain things in order to get what they want. And by that, I mean in a system in which leaders are chosen by either the people at large or a significant subset of them, politicians are necessarily put in a position where they are trying to appease a certain group of people, at least a certain amount that forms something like a majority in order to be chosen or elected. Whereas in a monarchy, and let's not forget that Tolkien favored unconstitutional monarchy over democracy here, that they, in this circumstance, in any kind of a democratic or semi-democratic system, this is the inevitable, perhaps, result of that sort of system, that politicians will necessarily end up becoming like this. You may start out in a fairly idealistic society with very straightforward, honest, and principled men or women seeking the offices that are elected, but in the end, human nature being what it is, politicians will always end up basically just being liars trying to gain power, because that's the kind of thing that happens with humans. Humans are broken, especially if you share Tolkien's worldview that humans are a fallen species in need of salvation. That, of course, is his Catholic background speaking, and I tend to agree with that. I share his basic view in that sense. And so I also tend to see most humans as fallen, and well, not most, all, but the result of that is anybody who tends to seek power tends to be probably on the sketchy side. And we can see echoes of this in a lot of different places. For example, C.S. Lewis in Prince Caspian even has Aslan ask Caspian at one point, "Do you think you're ready to be king?" And Caspian says, "No, I don't think I am." And Aslan replies, "Good, because if you thought you were, it would be proof that you weren't." Because there is a certain amount of hubris that goes into thinking that you are in any way capable or ready of ruling a large population all by yourself. Humans aren't actually capable of that. It's one thing to be a good leader, it's another thing to think that you are capable of being a good leader. And good leaders generally don't assume that they can do that very well. They just do the job that's handed to them as well as they can. And then other people follow suit, as they do well or not. This is a thing that is a shared idea between Tolkien, Lewis, and a bunch of other similar writers. Now, what I want to look at here is how Saruman fits this mold of the politician as opposed to, say, somebody like Aragorn, Théoden, or Faramir, or these other types of characters who accept the leadership roles that have been handed to them by fate, by, you know, it, in most of these cases, of course, it's blood lineage that they fall into, but not the kind of person who is necessarily seeking power for its own sake. So let's take a look at some of the things that Saruman says and see what we can derive in terms of comparing him to politicians of the modern day. So most of the material that we're going to look at comes from the conversation that Gandalf and Saruman have when Gandalf visits Saruman, and this is a story that he relays later at the Council of Elrond. We don't know about it when it happens. But the conversation that they have when he goes to seek out Saruman's help in response to Radagast finding him, which, of course, I talked about recently in my video on the disappearance of Gandalf and how that's handled differently between the book and the movie. So if you're not familiar with the differences there and you're not sure what I'm talking about because you've only seen the movie, go watch that video. Because also the stuff I'm going to be talking about here is also very different, because this conversation is not really the same in the book as it is in the movie. So if you haven't seen the, if you haven't read the book and you've only seen the movie, you're going to be getting some really interesting stuff about Saruman that you wouldn't necessarily have known. But the first real hint that we have that Saruman is a really, really bad dude, let's say, is when, you know, he asks Gandalf why he's there. Gandalf says, "I've come to seek your help because the Nine are abroad, as Radagast told me." And Saruman immediately starts unloading on Radagast, calling him the simple and the fool. And he kind of ends this first salvo of whatever it is he's trying to do by saying that he is Saruman Ringmaker, Saruman of many colors. He gives himself these titles, including Saruman the Wise. And one of the things that we can see here is the hubris that I was kind of mentioning earlier. Saruman is putting himself out there as the guy who has it all. He is a ringmaker. He is Saruman of many colors, which to him, unlike to Gandalf, who is going to criticize that, to him, he thinks that that means he's awesome. He's kind of got everything going. He's not just white, because as he will say later, white serves only as a beginning. A white page can be overwritten, this sort of thing. Saruman thinks that his beginnings as Saruman the White was just a beginning, but now he's kind of filled up the page, as it were, with all the colors of the rainbow, and so now he's, you know, I don't know exactly what he's going for here. I kind of like Corey Olson's theory, which is that by saying he is, Saruman of many colors, he's actually saying that he is the expert in all the fields that were covered by the wizards who have each their own color. So if he means it like that, basically what he's saying is, I am the everything expert. I've got everything going for me. And of course, he's also saying that he is Saruman the Wise. And this one in particular is important, I think, because yes, all of these wizards and certain elves are considered the Wise, with a capital W, which is the way that they're often referred to in the book, and there's a certain meaning to that, but Saruman here seems to be taking on a slightly different concept. It's not exactly clear what he means by it, but he's calling himself the Wise, as if he uniquely has a certain wisdom, and he's about to share that wisdom, such as he thinks it is, with Gandalf. And here's kind of our first look into that idea of how he is a template for a modern politician. Because modern politicians rarely, if ever, will admit anything like, you know, I don't know about that. I'm going to have to research that. I'm going to have experts kind of fill me in on that, or anything like this. In fact, anybody who's followed American politics, you know, I can't speak for politics outside the United States that much, but especially in American politics, pretty much any time in the last 20 to 30 years, will have noticed that anytime somebody says anything that is remotely indicative of the fact that they're not really sure what they're talking about, and I'll give an example of this in a minute, is just roundly criticized as a complete idiot who doesn't belong in the office of, say, the United States president or whatever it is. One example that I remember distinctly about this was from, I don't remember what year it was. I think it might have been 2012 or maybe it was 2016. Probably not 2016. That would have been too late. So probably 2012, but it was whenever Gary Johnson got the nomination for the Libertarian Party. And if you're not really familiar with United States politics, you probably wouldn't even know we had a Libertarian Party because it's a very minor party and there's only two major ones. But he got the nomination and there was something going on in some part of the world called Aleppo. It was a town in some country, and I don't even know what country it was now because it's been a while since anybody talked about it. But Gary Johnson, I don't remember if he frankly admitted he didn't know where Aleppo was or if he said something that implied he didn't know where Aleppo was. But as soon as this happened, basically everybody in the media and a bunch of other people as well were criticizing him, saying, you know, he doesn't know anything about Aleppo. He doesn't deserve to be president. Now, keep in mind here that unless you're under the assumption that the United States' business is to be involved in every crisis of almost any significance anywhere in the world, the idea that somebody running for the office of president, who isn't president yet, needs to know about every single thing going on in the world that might have made a news headline somewhere is absurd. That's just... Now, maybe you do think that's the United States' business, but like Gary Johnson was running on the Libertarian ticket, and Libertarians tend to be on the more non-interventionist side of the spectrum with the idea that they don't think the United States ought to be intervening everywhere in the world just because there's some kind of humanitarian crisis or whatever. So the idea that he would know about this is almost assuming that he believes things that he doesn't believe. And this is hardly the only instance of this, right? But the point I'm trying to make is that Saruman here is doing exactly what a politician normally does, which is pretend he knows everything about everything, because if he doesn't know everything about everything, then the moment he slips up, makes any tiny little gaffe, you know, misspeaks in any way, everybody dogpiles and is basically acting like this person just knows nothing and therefore doesn't deserve to be in any kind of political office, which is, again, absurd. Nobody can be informed about everything everywhere, but politicians have to pretend they are, and of course, often politicians running for office or in office have people who inform them about the things that they might expect to get questions on these days. But that's the point. They have to be informed of them by their staff because there's no way one person can keep up with all this stuff. Saruman here is claiming the opposite. He's like, I've got it all. I am the wise. I know everything. I have all the colors. I've got it all going for me. I know what's right and what's wrong. I know what we need to do. So, like I said, this is our first kind of hint of where Saruman is going. After a brief exchange in which Saruman displays a bit more of his pride and Gandalf criticizes his idea of not being white anymore, Saruman, and this one is a great one because this really does highlight a lot of things all in one, so I'm actually going to read the passage. Gandalf says, "He drew himself up, then and began to declaim as if he were making a speech long rehearsed." Note that. "The elder days are gone, the middle days are passing, the younger days are beginning. The time of the elves is over, but our time is at hand, the world of men which we must rule. But we must have power, power to order all things as we will, for that good which only the wise can see." Now, this is just the beginning of it, and I'm going to end up reading some more of it as well, but I definitely want to stop here because there's already multiple things going on in this passage that ought to set off alarm bells. He draws himself up and begins to declaim as if making a speech long rehearsed. How many politicians ever give extemporaneous, impromptu speeches? It doesn't happen. And the reason it doesn't happen is partially because of what I mentioned before, which is you can't not know everything going into something. You have to be absolutely 100% prepared so that you don't make a mistake, so that you don't get jumped on as somebody who's an ignoramus or, you know, a backwoods rube who doesn't know what he's talking about. And so, you know, Saruman has been preparing this for Gandalf so that he can give this speech. But notice the funny thing. He gets in about halfway through this paragraph without actually saying anything. The elder days are gone, the middle days are passing, the younger days are beginning. Now, are those things true? Yeah, I mean they are. The elder days are gone. That, you know, that's like the first age, Silmarillion type stuff. The middle days are passing. Middle days being, you know, post-first age, but before the world of men. And then he goes on to the younger days, and then he, you know, kind of defines what he means by that. The elves are leaving, and the world of men is about to begin. All of that is true, but does it really say anything useful at this point? No. I mean, first of all, Gandalf knows all this, right? Gandalf knows that the elves are leaving, and that they're probably not going to, you know, stay much longer. This is kind of a commonly known thing among people who know much about what's going on in Middle-earth at this point. But does any of this explain any of Saruman's later attempts to, you know, persuade Gandalf, explain his own motivations? Does it do any? No, it doesn't. The fact that time is passing and that certain changes come with history does not by itself tell you anything about what, you know, policies should be enacted, what strategies should be used, any of this kind of stuff. But this is exactly the kind of thing that you get in a lot of political speeches. You'll get, and it's become so, what's the word? Common is an understatement. It's become so universal, so ubiquitous, that it's almost a cliche at this point that politicians use platitudes all the time. Why? Because they're easy to say, and they don't say anything. Platitudes get thrown around like crazy because platitudes can just be thrown out there and they sound great, but they mean practically nothing. Now, platitudes can mean something specific if you really nail them down, but generally speaking, they are used in much the same way that Saruman is speaking here, which is to say, to mean nothing of any real significance, but to make it sound like something impressive is being said. That is generally the way politicians speak. And it's quite annoying when you when you have your eyes open enough to see what's going on and you notice these things, you begin to realize that in my opinion, and, you know, your opinion may vary, but in my opinion, probably 90 to 99% of all politicians don't really ever say much of anything more significant than a platitude, and they do that for less than, you know, honorable reasons, because all they're really trying to do is get elected, not because, you know, they're trying to convey a message that means something and that has value. So this is one thing we can take from this. Another one is the end of this paragraph. He says, "The world of men which we must rule, but we must have power to order all things as we will, for that good which only the wise can see." Here is Saruman the technocrat, right? This is, and, you know, I'm not going to get into specific names or anything, but we can all think of people within the last decade or two who have basically, you know, said that, you know, we're the experts, we know what's right and wrong, we know what, you know, to do in this situation because we have, you know, the technical expertise to explain to all you people who know nothing how we should go about doing whatever it is we need to do. This is also very typical of politicians, and not just politicians. This also applies to bureaucrats. You know, pretty much anybody who fills a role in which they are expected to make decisions that is either elected by, you know, the population or put in place by the people who were elected by the population. You know, in administrative agencies, at least in the United States, the people in them are usually appointed, but they're appointed by politicians. and they're appointed to fill specific roles based on, theoretically, the expertise that they have that matches that role. So, you know, you've got the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, whose job is to kind of regulate food labeling and what's safe and not safe. People in that, you would expect to be experts in their field. There's the Federal Aviation Agency. You would expect those people to be aviation experts in some form or another. These people are all put in their positions to be experts in a particular field, just like we tend to want to think that the people we elect to office are also experts in some way at doing what they do. Now, the kind of people that get elected to more general offices don't tend to be quite the same as the bureaucrats in that they don't claim specialized expertise. But you will very often, especially in anybody running for national office, and especially for president, is what you'll get is arguments about who has, you know, experience in, say, foreign policy. This happens in, I can't remember a presidential election cycle where this didn't come up. I have more experience in foreign policy than you do because you've spent no time in the federal government. I have more foreign policy experience than you do because I was in the Senate and you were just some, you know, state legislator or whatever. It happens every time. Now, how much foreign policy experience do these people actually have? You know, it's really hard to say, partially because the people who are in Congress and the Senate, usually when they're talking about foreign policy, have a lot of things going on behind closed doors. And I'm not criticizing the fact that they happen behind closed doors, because some things probably do need to be said in secret and not in the open so that, you know, national security secrets don't get leaked and things like this. But the point is, it's rare that the people electing, you know, these politicians can actually judge who has better foreign policy experience. And as somebody has said recently, which I thought was a great line, and again, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to date this video or anything. Somebody recently said, you know, foreign policy experience is not the same as foreign policy wisdom. You may have a lot of experience in a field, but it's like there is an old, you know, the motivational posters that always have something nice to say. At one time there was, and they may still be out there, I don't know, but at one time I remember there was a demotivational poster thing where you could kind of get the opposite of that. And they were all jokes, and one of them was great. It was, consistency is only a virtue if you're not a total screw-up. And the image was of an archery target with an arrow hitting the very bottom of the target, so way off the bullseye, and a second arrow splitting the first arrow. Yeah, you may have experience, but your experience may be in making all the mistakes. So the point there is, just because you have experience or expertise doesn't mean you're going to make good decisions. Human beings with expertise make bad decisions in their own field all the time for various reasons, because they're biased, because they have their own agendas, but you name it. Again, humans are fallen, they make mistakes, they don't even just make mistakes, they do actively bad things. This is, humans we know do this, so it's not, Anyway, point being, Saruman is, again, trying to step into this role of the technocrat. I am the expert. I know what to do. Very much in the vein of elected politicians and bureaucratic experts who say they know what they're doing. Now Saruman moves on, and so far Saruman has not exactly been a nice guy. He's been a little bit abrasive, to put it mildly. But now he kind of calms down a bit, like he's going to try to pull Gandalf into his orbit. He said, "And listen, Gandalf, my old friend and helper," he said, coming near and speaking now in a softer voice. "I said, we, for we it may be, if you will join with me. A new power is rising. Against it, the old allies and policies will not avail us at all. There is no hope left in elves or dying Numenor. This, then, is one choice before you, before us. We may join with that power. It would be wise, Gandalf. There is hope that way. its victory is at hand, and there will be rich reward for those that aided it. Saruman here is very, very obviously taking the ends justifies the means approach, and he will get even more deep into that as we go along. But he's basically saying, this is inevitable. Therefore, our wisest policy is not to resist the inevitable, but rather to join with the inevitable. And then he's later going to say, we can come with patience to direct the power. Now, the power he's talking about here is Sauron, which it's kind of interesting that he says a new power is rising, because Sauron is anything but new. Sauron has been around since the First Age, and he's been mucking things up the whole time. I can only assume that what he means here is the fact that Sauron is now returned after a very long absence and is in that very limited sense new. But here again, we can see something like a politician's hallmarks peeking through, because politicians love to act like everything that's going on is, you know, kind of a not a long-standing problem that everybody already knows the answer to, you know, because they have nothing to offer as a politician with expertise, let's say, if the solution to the problem is already known. If the problem is an old one, which hasn't already been tried, you know, and attempted to be solved multiple times in the same exact way that the politician is now offering. Which is why so often you'll hear politicians, if you really pay attention over the course of time, politicians will make promises like, I will solve this problem by doing X. But if you look at history, a lot of the time, what you'll find is politicians have been trying to solve that exact same problem by doing X for years, and it has not solved the problem. One of those things, just as an example, is the downhill slide of education in the United States is something that is a frequent topic in certain political races, and one of the things that is usually offered up as a solution to that is, well, we need more funding for schools. We've been increasing funding for schools for decades and decades and decades, and education has not improved. But it's always brought up like this is a new thing, like we need more funding, and that'll solve everything. We've been trying that. Saruman is doing the same thing. He's doing the same exact thing because he's pointing to an old problem, acting like it's a new problem, which they can try to solve in a new way, which is not really new, as Gandalf is going to point out eventually. Saruman continues, as the power grows, its proved friends will also grow, and the wise, such as you and I, may with patience come at last to direct its courses, to control it. We can bide our time, we can keep our thoughts in our hearts, deploring maybe evils done by the way, but approving the high and ultimate purpose, knowledge, rule, order, all the things that we have so far striven in vain to accomplish, hindered rather than helped by our weak or idle friends. There need not be, there would not be, any real change in our designs, only in our means. This is where he really drops the veil and comes out as ends justifies the means. And this is so common in the political class. It's like, we have to do this, and because we have to do this, we're just going to have to sacrifice this thing over here. And a lot of the time, the thing sacrificed is something that's considered fundamental to the political structure that is, you know, that they're working within. So as an example of that, back when, you know, really nasty events happened in the early 2000s, which many of you may recall, there was a push in the United States to pass legislation that would allow much, much broader surveillance authority to the United States government. And it was just so important that we stop terrorism around the world that we had to sacrifice certain rights that everybody assumed we had in terms of privacy and this sort of thing. And as time went on, of course, we realized that things were even worse than was thought at the time, and that the government has been snooping on people ever since in really invasive ways. Now, you can make an argument one way or the other about whether any violations of, say, the United States Constitution actually took place there, but the point is, a lot of people who found out about this kind of long after the fact because they just didn't really want to think about it at the time suddenly realized, hey, wait a minute, you've gone too far. And they always assumed that they had those rights, whether or not they actually did. So this is the same kind of thing that Saruman is doing. This goal is so important, and the only way we can achieve it is by sacrificing our principles. Okay, that doesn't sound good. Because now what you're saying is, Saruman says our actual design doesn't change, only the means. But what Gandalf hears, and what we should hear when we hear politicians talking about this, is no, actually, you know, the end included those means in a sense. Because Saruman is talking about sacrificing literally everything that is valuable about the right side of the conflict in order to, quote-unquote, win it. But when he's going to win it, he's going to have sacrificed everything that was worth fighting for. And Gandalf recognizes that. The reason that you can't sacrifice and you can't justify the means in order to attain the end is because the end is not merely victory in the broadest, most amorphous sense. Because then you end up with what Faramir talks about when he has a conversation with Frodo, where he says, you know, Frodo, you know, says basically, would you have two dark towers grinning at each other across an absolutely wasted landscape? And Faramir says, no, I would not have it so. And the idea there is once both sides have resorted to ends justify the means, that's what results. You end up with two sides who are trying to win at all costs. And it's really interesting, actually. I kind of wish that Tolkien had left this in the final draft of The Lord of the Rings, but in an early draft, I think it's Imrahil, but it might have been some other minor character, basically says, if we're going to pull out all the stops and go all the way and, you know, sacrifice all of our principles in defeating Mordor, we might as well just let Mordor win. Like, less loss, right? I mean, that way we don't all die in the attempt, and, you know, we get the same result, but with less loss of life and suffering along the way. Like, if you've sacrificed all the principles that really were the thing that you should have been fighting for, why are you even fighting anymore? It's just power versus power at that point. This is where Saruman is really laying it out on the table, because what he's showing is that's what he cares about, power. And this goes back to Lord Acton's aphorism that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And somebody has added, and I've added many times, but somebody else, I think relatively famous compared to me, has added the kind of addendum to that, which is people who seek power tend to already be corrupt. The idea of seeking power used to be frowned upon, so much so that in the Catholic tradition there was this idea of nolo episcopare, which was the idea that I don't want to be bishop. And that was a sign that you were a good choice to be bishop, which goes back to that Aslan and Prince Caspian conversation that I talked about earlier. If you think you're ready and you want that role, you probably shouldn't be in it, because what you really need to have in a role like that is humility, not hubris. Hubris leads you to do stupid and bad things. Humility will at least restrain you and keep you from going way out of bounds. So Saruman here has dropped the veil, basically, but he's doing it in a way that he's trying to convince Gandalf, and so he has that low and nicer voice where he's trying to convince him, and Gandalf is having none of it, of course. He ends up saying, I've heard this kind of speech before, but only in the voices of emissaries of Mordor who are trying to basically convince other people to become slaves. He doesn't put it quite that way, but let's be honest, that's ultimately what's going on. Yeah, at least in the instances Gandalf is thinking about, probably. Because ultimately, that is what Mordor is all about, is enslaving its enemies. And of course, we get that straight from the horse's mouth, as it were, when the mouth of Sauron will end up telling them, you know, you've all got to withdraw past the Anduin, you'll all be tributaries, and this land over here is just going to be Sauron solely. So it's like they'll be free, but they'll be tributary. So everybody knows what that means. Ultimately, they're all going to come under the sway of Sauron, and it'll all be Sauron's. So, this is the direction that this sort of thing goes. Saruman, after Gandalf criticizes him and calls out his Mordor-like tendencies, then offers to basically go for a second route. And he says, well, so this option doesn't really appeal to you, so what about the second option? What if we had the Ruling Ring, and then we could have the power, and we could just control it outright? Because Saruman so far has been talking about Sauron's victory is inevitable, he's going to get the ring, he's going to rule the world, and we will have to kind of bide our time and eventually come to try to control that, which is a fool's fantasy to begin with. And there's, elements of politicians in that too. It's like some politicians often think that they can achieve things that are just not realistic at all. But not to go too deep there, but then he shifts and says, what if we had the Ruling Ring and then we just had the power and we don't even have to bide our time and we just do it ourselves? Gandalf sees through this as well, of course, and he says, don't bother to say we, because only one hand at a time can rule, can wear the Ruling Ring. And Gandalf is pointing out something else here, which is politicians, especially in something like democratic style governments, will constantly play the tune of I am the public servant, and therefore it's actually the people who are in charge. But very rarely is that actually the case. The people very rarely matter in terms of having their voice heard. Once a politician is in office, they go after their agenda. And usually that agenda is paying back, major donors, running for a second term, or whatever it is. It'd be, I dare say, if you went and looked at, for example, any given politician and the promises they make when running for office, and then compare their voting record after they're in office, and then compare that again with their rhetoric while in office, that everything matches up. It just doesn't happen very often. There are a few out there probably who do, but I would be willing to bet again that if you looked, 90%+ don't actually match up with what they promise in terms of their actions when they hold office. It just doesn't happen. So again, what we're looking at here is a very political type of mindset where the promise is, we share the power because it's, you and me, buddy. But that's not realistic and it doesn't happen. What actually happens is one person has that power and they use it for themselves. And what does that mean for everybody else? They suddenly don't matter as much once the power is in the hands of the person who's seeking it. Another thing I did want to point out before that I've neglected to mention was Saruman's emphasis on the ends that they're looking for: knowledge, rule, and order. Okay, I love this because knowledge, rule, and order are all perfectly fine things, but they're not ends in themselves. Knowledge can be used for good or ill. Rule can be benevolent or tyrannical. Order can be, valuable, but it can also be over strict. Just as an example in, again, US politics, because that's, what I'm most familiar with, most of the time, especially in the last few decades or so, a lot of the time you'll hear the two sides of most major, candidates' policies and whatnot. You'll hear things like on the Republican side, they'll say, we need law and order. And that sounds great because we do want to curb criminality. But at the same time, if you look at some of the things that Republicans want to do in terms of how to impose law and order, again, it kind of skirts on the edge of or crosses way over the edge of violating constitutional guarantees. On the flip side, Democrats will often talk about how they're the party of science, and they also even will, despite their claims, also support a lot of violations of the U.S. Constitution, even on the law and order aspect. It just depends, right? There's no real consistency on either side for the most part. They'll promise all these things that sound good, but in you know, in pursuance of what they claim they're pursuing, they'll end up trotting on people left and right to get there. And it's really ugly to watch if you're paying attention. And this is why Tolkien didn't like democracy and he favored anarchy or unconstitutional monarchy. And, you know, who could blame him? And there's more stuff to Saruman, of course. We get more conversation between him and Gandalf where he really tries to pull Gandalf in on his side when he's lost. Here he's taking a more superior approach, and there he tries to, you know, later on when he's defeated, he tries to act like he's, you know, more of a supplicant than a generous offeror of a great opportunity. But in both cases, one of the things that we see is that Saruman will, when, you know, really confronted with the dishonesty of his own position, just blow up in anger. He does not brook opposition. And this is true of a lot of politicians. And you can imagine some of them, you know, I don't have to name names again, but the people who want this kind of power want it because they think they deserve it. And when you think you deserve that power and somebody comes along and points out how you're being dishonest or whatever, that does not sit well with somebody with that kind of arrogance. So, just, again, the whole idea here is that Saruman looks so much like a modern politician, it's not even, it's uncanny how well Tolkien captured this whole idea. And, again, it kind of goes back to, A, his Christian, you know, fundamental beliefs about man being fallen, but also his not very hidden dislike for politicians and his preference for something like a more traditional monarchy that, you know, you can really see coming through here. So that is a rather detailed look at what I think is how Saruman really matches up to politicians in the modern day. And as should be clear by now, I'm not using this in a one-sided fashion. I think this goes, you know, all directions. There's no political party out there who does not escape, you know, who escapes this criticism. I think it's true of basically all of them. So I'm not trying to be one-sided and say that, you know, your side is bad, my side is good. No, they're all bad. And this is what Tolkien would say. Like, even during World War II, he says there's orcs on both sides. He tells this to Christopher in a letter at one point. It's like, you know, there's bad people everywhere. That's just the nature of, you know, who humans are. And Saruman, for all his claim to be wise and for all his being a Maia instead of an actual man, proves himself to be, you know, just a more powerful and in that way, a worse version of what man is, because the corruption of the higher is the worse. The better a thing is, the worse its corruption is. So, Saruman as politician, what do you think about my analysis? Did I miss anything that you think is significant? Do you think I'm totally off base? Should be an interesting conversation in the comments. Try not to get into individual political things if you can. I tried to avoid it as much as I could here. I kind of had to throw in the Republican-Democrat divide towards the end to kind of explain what I was getting at. But, you know, keep the comments civil, because anything that gets political can obviously get very heated, and I don't want that in the comments section. Try to keep it at a high level and very, very, you know, charitable towards everybody. But, yeah, do leave your comments below if you can keep it in that vein. And if you like the video, please give it a thumbs up, share it around. Make sure you check out the description for all the support and social links. Follow me on the platform formerly known as Twitter for Tolkien-related trivia questions every week. And, of course, you can join my Discord and all that other good stuff. Until the next time, I'm the Tolkien Geek, signing out for the Tolkien Lore Channel. Namarie.
Thanks to all my channel supporters, especially Elf Friends Paul Leone, Nathan Dufour, and Robert Kindling.